It is my junior year, 1978, when disco and Rocky movies are the cultural rage. We are in an unusual sociology class at Brandeis, something Morey calls group process. Each week we study the ways in which the students in the group interact with one another, how they respond to anger, jealousy, attention. We're human lab rats. More often than not, someone ends up crying. I refer to it as the touchy-feely course. Morey says I should be more open-minded. On this day, Morey says he has an exercise for us to try. We are to stand facing away from our classmates and fall backward, relying on another student to catch us. Most of us are uncomfortable with this, and we cannot let go for more than a few inches before stopping ourselves. We laugh in embarrassment. Finally, one student, a thin, quiet, dark-haired girl whom I noticed almost always wears bulky white fisherman sweaters, crosses her arms over her chest, closes her eyes, leans back, and does not flinch, like one of those Lipton tea commercials where the model splashes into the pool. For a moment, I'm sure she's going to thump on the floor. At the last instant, her assigned partner grabs her head and shoulders and yanks her up harshly. "Whoa!" several students yell. Some even clap. Morey finally smiles. "You see," he says to the girl, "you closed your eyes, and that was the difference. Sometimes you can't believe what you see, you have to believe what you feel. And if you are ever going to have other people trust you, you must feel that you can trust them too, even when you're in the dark, even when you're falling." The third Tuesday, we talk about regrets. The next Tuesday, I arrive with the normal bags of food, pasta with corn, potato salad, apple cobbler, and something else, a Sony tape recorder. "I want to remember what we talk about," I told Morey. "I want to have your voice so I can listen to it later." "When I'm dead," he said. "Don't say that." He laughed. "Mitch, I'm going to die, and sooner, not later." He regarded the new machine. "So big," he said. I felt intrusive, as reporters often do, and I began to think that a tape machine between two people who were supposedly friends was a foreign object, an artificial ear. With all the people clamoring for his time, perhaps I was trying to take too much from these Tuesdays. "Listen," I said, packing up the recorder, "we don't have to use this. If it makes you uncomfortable..." He stopped me, wagged a finger, then hooked his glasses off his nose, letting them dangle on the string around his neck. He looked me square in the eye. "Put it down," he said. I put it down. "Mitch," he continued softly now, "you don't understand. I want to tell you about my life. I want to tell you before I can't tell you anymore." His voice dropped to a whisper. "I want someone to hear my story. Will you?" I nodded. We sat quietly for a moment. "So," he said, "is it turned on?" Now, the truth is, that tape recorder was more than nostalgia. I was losing Morey. We were all losing Morey, his family, his friends, his ex-students, his fellow professors, his pals from the political discussion group that he loved so much, his former dance partners. All of us were losing Morey. And I suppose tapes, like photographs and videos, are a desperate attempt to steal something from death's suitcase. But it was also becoming clear to me, through his courage, his humor, his patience, and his openness, that Morey was looking at life from some very different place than anyone else I knew. A healthier place. A more sensible place. And he was about to die. If some mystical clarity of thought came when you looked death in the eye, then I knew Morey wanted to share it, and I wanted to remember it for as long as I could. The first time I saw Morey on Nightline, I wondered what regrets he had once he knew his death was imminent. Did he lament lost friends? Would he have done much differently? Selfishly, I wondered if I were in his shoes, would I be consumed with sad thoughts of all that I had missed? Would I regret the secrets I had kept hidden? When I mentioned this to Morey, he nodded. "It's what everyone worries about, isn't it?" he said. "What if today were my last day on Earth?" He studied my face, and perhaps he saw an ambivalence about my own choices. I had this vision of me keeling over at my desk one day, halfway through a story, my editors snatching the copy even as the medics carried my body out. "Mitch," Morey said. I shook my head and said nothing, but Morey picked up on my hesitation. "Mitch, the culture doesn't encourage you to think about such things until you're about to die. We're so wrapped up with egotistical things, career, family, having enough money, meeting the mortgage, getting a new car, fixing the radiator when it breaks. We're involved in trillions of little acts just to keep going. So we don't get into the habit of standing back and looking at our lives and saying, is this all? Is this all I want? Is something missing? You need someone to probe you in that direction. It won't just happen automatically. I knew what he was saying. We all need teachers in our lives. And mine was sitting right in front of me. Fine, I figured. If I was to be the student, then I would be as good a student as I could be. On the plane ride home that day, I made a small list on a yellow legal pad. Issues and questions that we all grapple with, from happiness to aging to having children and even to death. Of course, there were a million self-help books on these subjects, and plenty of cable TV shows and $90 per hour consultation sessions. America had become a Persian bazaar of self-help, but there still seemed to be no clear answers. Do you take care of others or take care of your inner child? Return to traditional values or reject tradition as useless? Seek success or seek simplicity? Just say no or just do it? All I knew was this. Maury, my old professor, wasn't in the self-help business. He was standing on the tracks, listening to death's locomotive whistle, and he was very clear about the important things in life. I wanted that clarity. Every confused and tortured soul I knew wanted that clarity. Ask me anything, Maury always said. So I wrote this list on the plane. Death, fear, aging, greed, marriage, family, society, forgiveness, and a meaningful life. The list was in my bag when I returned to West Newton for the fourth time, a Tuesday in late August, when the air conditioning at the Logan Airport terminal was not working, and people fanned themselves and wiped sweat angrily from their foreheads, and every face I saw looked ready to kill somebody.